Welcome to the Watch OK Please podcast, a podcast where three friends try to convince each other to devote what little time they have left to watch more TV and or movies than they've ever wanted to watch. Please join us while we argue about our media cues and waste everyone's valuable time on things that just don't matter. Hey Watchers, it's Nyan, and thank you for joining us on another episode of the Watch OK Please podcast. This is actually our 21st episode. Can't believe we've made it 21 episodes in. Thank you for sticking around, and hope you continue to enjoy the nonsense we put out there. First up on this week's episode, the full panel gets deep into their feedback on the movie Patterson, which is available on Amazon Prime. Later in the episode, Dan sends us back to a future when he pitches the sci-fi series The Expanse that is available on Amazon Prime. As always, if you're enjoying or hating any part of this podcast, please rate and review us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You can also hit us up on our Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook pages, as we do monitor those outlets. You could also feel free to leave us a voicemail with a pitch of a show or movie you want us to watch on our Anchor page at anchor.fm/watchokplease. Finally, if all that's a pain, please feel free to complain about us on your social media platform of choice. All right, Watchers. Let's get into it. All right, guys, we're here for the feedback on the movie Patterson, which is available on Amazon Prime. This was a pitch from a listener, so it's actually kind of uncharted territory for us. So we actually have some specific feedback comments from the listener, so I'm going to go ahead and read those. And then get into what the rest of the panel and myself actually thought about this movie. So, as per longtime listener, first-time pitcher, he said it was actually friend of the pod, Sherv, who got me into Jim Jarmusch years ago when he showed me the movie Ghost Dog, which I loved. I previously heard of Jarmusch from a Wu-Tang compilation, Think Differently Music, in which he gives bite-sized morsels on his creative process. Fast forward to a few years ago when I stumbled on this on Amazon Prime. It was made in association with Amazon Studios, and I immediately fell in love with it. To me, our pitcher, this was the exact opposite of Ferris Bueller. It follows a quiet, humble poet, husband, and bus driver as he makes art for himself and listens to the world around him with little judgment. I've recommended this movie to others and find it to be a Rorschach test on a variety of things, chief among them, the role of art in the viewer's life. As a film, he really enjoyed how it played with his expectations as a viewer. No, the dog was never in danger of being stolen. No, the lovesick actor didn't actually try to commit murder-suicide. No, the bus didn't explode into a fireball as everyone around Patterson expected. I think what follows are his opinions and interpretations as to what this is about. As he predicts that there may be some debate, and he has rebuttals and maybe some hot takes, because to him, this is a week in the life of a former Marine, not explained further, but we'll get back to that, as he creates meaningful poetry for himself and curiously observes others around him. He takes an interest in others' stories, but doesn't judge or seek to influence. The pitcher's interpretation is that Patterson is in a loving, fulfilling relationship with his wife, Laura, who is herself talented in a few mediums and has a completely different stance on art. Laura wants to share her art with the world, whether it's cupcakes or music. And maybe he's projecting, but he saw these differences between them as complementing their relationship. And the pitcher says some friends who he's recommended this to have felt that Patterson lives a boring or unhappy life, or perhaps is dealing with some sort of trauma from his military service with his routine and his poetry. And while he respects those interpretations and considers them in rewatches, he feels Patterson truly enjoyed poetry from his knowledge of its style, talking with the waiting twin. Get into that too, and his bookshelf and his references to other poets. On trauma, it looks like Patterson sleeps through the night, and he never displays anger, even when that really bad thing happens. His use of alcohol appears pretty limited and social. And though he's quiet, he's facing outward, observing, and often enjoying what he witnesses, while still withholding judgment. So at this point, the pitcher says he could go on, but he wants to hear what we thought. So one of his first questions is that there is a lot of recurring themes in imagery. The twins, Laura's use of black and white colors, recurring dialogue like the bus and exploding in a fireball. Did you like this in the film, or do you think it was too cheesy?
So, I mean, for me, I mean, I think that there's a lot to unpack here, what he's saying here. And I think that I kind of do see a bit of the Rorschach test question coming into play. As far as the themes are concerned, I think that, you know, what I thought to me was that, okay, maybe this is supposed to be initially foreshadowing for something, is what I was actually kind of hinting at least on the twins' perspective. And the more I thought about it, basically, it's like, I thought, well, maybe this is just a metaphor for something he's coming to terms with. Again, the Marine thing was only briefly, you know, kind of hinted at, basically, you know, through it, but there wasn't harped on a lot. So, I mean, could you say that the twins could represent basically his eyes normally come in pairs, and the black and white colors could, you know, kind of speak to kind of, you know, how he views the world, and then the exploding fireball could basically be the whole, you know, experience of his life. So there's a lot of different ways you can kind of go into interpretations, I think. And I think that, you know, without talking with, you know, the creators themselves and getting a little bit more deep in this, I mean, I don't know if we'll get a whole definitive answer, but there's a lot that, you know, behind it, I think.
So did you like the way all that stuff kind of came out, or did it feel weird?
It felt a little like sometimes it was like effortlessly put in, and sometimes it was a little more disjointed. But I think a lot of it had to do with situationally, like, you know, what was happening. If he's like walking on the street, I mean, that's cool. You see twins, you know, it happens. I liked, spoiler alert, you know, I liked how, you know, he met the other young poet, and it turns out she was a twin. So I thought that was a kind of neat way to throw that reference in there. And I felt that one felt a little more natural to me. Because I mean, walking on the street and you're seeing twins all the time. I mean, I don't know how prevalent twins are in a statistical perspective. I only see maybe on the streets, I might see one pair of twins maybe a year, and not including television or other programming. So I don't know.
You know, now that we talk about it more, I almost wonder if the twins thing I couldn't quite pin down what that was supposed to be about, but I almost, as we're talking through it, it makes it seem like perhaps the prevalence of the twins was just a way of demonstrating how interesting life can be if you're paying attention, right? Like if you just see these repetitive patterns, the black and white patterns that, you know, keep showing up in Laura's work, and the twins, that even the most mundane things in life can be truly fascinating, and that Jeremy's kind of found a better way to demonstrate those. I just throwing that out there. So now, like, as we're talking through it, and because initially just didn't get it, I kind of like the way it worked.
Well, that's what I thought too. I was just confused by the twins more than anything. Like, I wasn't sure what it was supposed to represent or imply, but I like the patterns and like the black and white shapes that they started out with the shower curtains, I think, and then also went to her clothes and then to the cupcakes themselves, just as like, I guess, an expression of her creativity in different ways, which I think her character, like you were saying, Nyan, is supposed to, the idea is that she feels comfortable and wants to share her creativity, you know, outwardly as opposed to Patterson. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the twins thing, what you're saying makes sense, but it's hard to kind of think about that as you were watching it.
Yeah, I mean, I think also that the patterns that she's displaying there, I mean, some of them are, they symbolize kind of either swirls or other kinds of different patterns. And it's very interesting to see, you know, how the different, you know, patterns might represent basically, you know, how she, you know, expresses her creativity in that regard. You know, there's more of an impulsive kind of, you know, expression that exists in that context in my mind. But,
and I think it was cool how she was very accepting of Patterson and the fact that he didn't really want to publish his poems or make copies of them. And like she just thought that she was trying to be supportive by saying she thought they were really good and mm-hmm. that other people might get some enjoyment out of them. But it didn't seem like she was really all that upset that he wasn't too interested in sharing them.
Right.
One of the other questions that the pitcher had for this particular point was, what'd you guys think of the on-screen displays of Patterson's poetry?
I I think it helps kind of try to, one thing of like get meaning from it, but just to help it to sink in more as opposed to if they just read it without the words on the screen. So I liked it. I thought it was cool.
Yeah, I think it definitely, also seeing it, on the screen and seeing how the breaks were coming out on a poetic perspective was really interesting too, to see how he was, writing them on the page, because obviously, if you're just, writing prose is a lot different than writing, poetry in this regard. So it's it was very interesting to see how that kind of played out, and also how the flow of what he was saying, and it was really neat, we almost got a way to almost look inside of his mind in some ways when he's making his art.
Yeah, I kind of liked it for those same reasons. It was kind of funny because it almost felt like, it exactly mirrored something, a device that's used in the show Dickinson that's on Apple Plus, which is appropriately Emily Dickinson. And that's done like that show is done, and it takes a very different approach to a poet, but they do a really good job with it. And the way that Emily Dickinson's poetry just shows up on the screen randomly throughout this all three seasons is done well. So for me, I almost wonder if they had pulled kind of a similar. I felt like they could Dickinson could have been inspired that approach in Dickinson could have been inspired by Patterson just because of the way. It was so similar that the text appeared on screen. And I personally thought it was real. The on-screen displays of poetry were very helpful in this regard, in the context of this particular movie.
And that'd be a cute little nod because Dickinson was one of Patterson's favorites. So.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, that would have been interesting. That would make perfect sense.
Yeah. But yeah, I feel like I'm trying to think if I've ever seen something in that kind of realm where someone's been writing in a book. I feel like I've seen that in animation. I can't think of any live action where I've seen that kind of happen. I mean, other than maybe for some reason, Jefferson in Paris is coming to mind. I don't know why, where I think maybe he's like writing a letter or something like that. And and maybe like the first line comes up, shows him, he's showing him writing the letter, but it's not really the poem. It's just really a letter. It's a matter of fact. It's factual. Account or whatever, or something. Whereas this is a lot more expressive. So I think that it's not the same kind of context in that regard.
Yeah, I was wondering about it as well in terms of it's probably been done before. I'm sure it's a Simpsons did it situation. Like,
yeah,
but they did do a good job, and I thought that the expression of it helped. It didn't hinder the movie itself. The second question I have from the picture is. He says, I know the members of the panel themselves have been into a wide array of art, for example, acting, stage production, singing. How do you connect with the film's take on art in everyday life? And where are you on the Patterson-Laura spectrum of art for yourself or for others? And did this resonate? Scott, would you?
Interesting question, yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think, Scott?
It was definitely... it was definitely a different approach than what I'm used to seeing in the shows or movies that I see, but I guess, yeah, it was a little off-putting, I would say, at first, but I think kind of what Nyan was alluding to earlier, saying that it's just meant to show that even what might be considered relatively normal or everyday things could have really interesting, aspects of them if you just, listen or pay attention to them, I should say. Even if I felt, I like that, when he was driving the bus, he would hear different pieces of people's conversations. And I almost expected him to have some kind of reaction to it, like to comment on it or tell Laura about it maybe later. But nothing, the movie didn't show that. He just is taking it in kind of and listening to what the people on the bus are talking about without making any judgments about it or anything like that. And so it was on the one hand, it's like, well, okay, so what does he think about that? Like, it felt a little unfulfilled. But then on the other hand, I am, again, towards what Nyan was saying, I guess it's kind of the point that he doesn't have to have a reaction to it. He's just observing and listening to what other people are, what's happening in other people's lives. And he finds it interesting. And I guess That's the idea that they were trying to get at.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. I mean, I definitely agree with a lot of what Scott was saying as well. I mean, as far as how, you know, this connects with this in art, everyday life. I mean, I'll be the first person to admit I don't think I'm nearly as creatively expressing myself as much as I used to. I think that especially, you know, back in our heyday when, you know, we were young and whatnot, I think we definitely did a lot more of that and through everyday life. And I think we do find beauty in different things, even in the chaotic world that we live in right now. And I think that, you know, contextually, it's not just the life he lives, but, like, you know, it's also where he is. You know, I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of environmental kinds of, you know, constraints that you say that, because the three of us live, you know, for the most part in either urban or suburban areas. And, you know, I think that, you know, we might experience things in a different kind of way than, say, someone living in Patterson who's not, like, I would say, even though it is in the New York City metro area, it's not necessarily, you know, I would call a cultural center of sorts. But that being said, there's a tremendous amount of people that, you know, come from Patterson that I didn't know about, which was kind of neat. But yeah, I think as far as, you know, where I see myself on that Patterson-Lawrence spectrum, I mean, I'm probably, you know, I feel like that when I do express myself, I kind of do things a little bit more, you know, expressively, like I would say Laura does. That being said, you know, I haven't done a lot of, you know, creative expression as of late, so I'm a little bit more in the observing mode of Patterson right now, as opposed to the outwardly expressing mode of Laura. But, you know, I think I think a lot of people will see themselves in some way, shape, or form. Like, some people bake, some people, you know, sing or play guitar, or they act, where the case is. I think that, you know, everyone has some sort of connection to art or writing or whatever the case is. And I think that, you know, that even if, like, you couldn't connect with Patterson in his, what I would call, relatively simple life, you couldn't connect to that. I think that the aspect of one's relationship with art, I think, is something that can resonate with a lot of people.
Fair enough. Scott, where do you feel like you fall on the Patterson-Laura spectrum for art?
I think probably kind of what Dan was saying, more on the Patterson side. Just also, it's unfortunate, but it seems like in our busy lives and thing, which I'm sure everyone has now, but it's hard to find the time or the kind of the motivation to explore that more, which is really a shame, because I would like to do that, and I think a lot of people would too. And then you would probably get a lot more people like Patterson than being able to address or kind of incorporate that part of themselves in their lives more. But it's just a challenge to do that these days.
It's incredibly hard. I think that, you know, I think I become so obsessed with consuming so much other content, pun intended, with considering that we're on right now. but I think I become so obsessed with consuming content and learning to explore and wanting things to kind of pick my brain as much as we would pick each other's brains or other people's brains in that regard in discussion, you know. But I think at the same time, it's kind of like, I wonder if I could, you know, if I had a more simple life where I could basically do things cyclically, where I could randomly wake up between 6:13 and 6:32 or 6:33 by automatically, you know, I think, you know, and if I had something where I could basically go do this, come out, and, you know, where, and I'd have, you know, defined moments where I could say, okay, I can sit down and write, or I can sit down and do this, you know, I think it'd be having that more, I would say, basic structure would be kind of, you know, nice in some ways, but at the same time, it's like, you know, I think that some people thrive on this whole dynamic nature of life, or complex nature of life, like Scott was, you know, mentioning. And, you know, again, it's a toss up. You know, it's like, you know, do I, you know, what, you know, how do we prize creativity? I mean, do we, again, and much what, you know, Nyan and also the listener was trying to express, you know, how do we want to share that creativity with the world? So,
what about you, Nyan?
You know, it's funny, and I kind of want to take this in the context of Jarmusch's work generally, because I've seen I was trying to go through his list. I was like, what have I seen? Because I've known about him forever. I've seen Mystery Train, Coffee and Cigarettes, Ghost Dog, of course. That was the one guy we introduced this to Jarmusch. But I hadn't seen a bunch of his other stuff, which is a shame because I've heard really good things. And I think what I have appreciated about these movies in the distinction is there is a very, very much a common theme of art in the everyday, sort of taking there being such these random, weird, odd situations that if you take the time to pay attention enough, these things will pop out at you randomly. For example, I actually watched this movie while I was staying at a Vrbo that we rented over the holidays for in downtown Newport, Rhode Island. Like we were right across the street from City Hall. So it was actually, I mean, not that I consider Newport, Rhode Island a particularly urban area. There were lots of people who would walk by the place we were at because we were on the first floor and we could hear them perfectly because it was a real old building. So I was having that Patterson experience of hearing these random conversations happening as people are walking by and catching pieces of it. And I was like, oh, this, I feel like I'm in a Jim Jarmusch movie because I feel like a lot of this is just observing people and watching them live their lives and finding the beauty in that and the interest in that. Like Mystery Train is the one that kind of comes across to me as hitting that the most. I mean, well, Coffee and Cigarettes completely because, well, Mystery Train is about folks in Memphis kind of having just different experiences. God, I hope it was Memphis. If it was Nashville, I'll shoot myself. And that's fine. That'll be good. Good podcast fodder. Oh no, it is Memphis. So ultimately, and Coffee and Cigarettes is just a bunch of random vignettes of people drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. I think Iggy Pop's involved. I remember the White Stripes show up. Like it is just this random stuff, random people just literally smoking and drinking coffee. And so that's very much a recurring theme with Jarmusch's work that I'm familiar with, at least. And I appreciate it. I love I like the way that it takes, you know, it's Patterson itself, going back to the movie we're actually talking about, took the time to actually, you know, quietly observe everything that's going on in Patterson, New Jersey. But the funny thing is I've been to Patterson, New Jersey. I've spent time around Patterson, New Jersey, and I don't know that it's this quiet of a place. It's definitely not the place, the kind of place I would hang out regularly. So it was just interesting to see Jarmusch's kind of romanticization of Patterson when it falls in the inner city. I'm trying to find a good way to say this without being a jerk.
That's what I was, you know, it definitely is a romanticization. I totally agree.
Because I remember I dated a girl who was doing med school rotations at the hospital downtown Patterson. I think it was St. Joseph's. And we would talk about how, like, you're dealing with such a, like, there's an Abompan, and that's the only random, like, food within the hospital that's available 24 hours a day. But you're dealing with a low-income population that they're not out there buying an Abompan. It's kind of messed up. It's this weird juxtaposition of Patterson thinking it's still in its heyday when it is not. So I guess I've gone on a bit of a tangent there from the original question.
But I totally agree with, like, you know, that it's possible to be metropolitan and the true, well, urban and not metropolitan, I guess is the way I want to put it. Because I think that there is, you know, you might not have, you know, a ripe cultural center like you might in like certain other places and other cities, you know, that exist. But again, for every, you know, lush cultural center that is safe to, that is 100% safe to be in, there's other places that people just live, and there's other places that might be unsafe, and there are other places that might be a mixture of all those things, maybe gentrified, not gentrified. So there's so many different, you know, things there. And I think that a lot of it has to do, I think, of Patterson in the same kind of realm as I do of some other cities, like where, you know, it was, you know, known for, you know, a specific industry, right? And, you know, when the majority of that industry or the interest of being or the interest of being in that town or the popularity of being in that town kind of subsides, it's like you're left with some, you know, I wouldn't call it imitation, but you're left basically with the leftover leftovers and a mixture of new blood that comes in to kind of work in that realm. And I think that that's kind of where it is as it relates to being a city in New Jersey, in my mind. Again, I haven't been there recently, so I can't speak to this. That's kind of where I imagine it to be in reality.
I think that's fair. Before I continue, we'll probably take a couple more shots of Patterson, New Jersey before this is done. But to answer the other question that was associated with this is, where am I on the Patterson lore spectrum of art? I think I'm kind of in the middle, because I do a lot of kind of random note-taking on my own. But then I took a stand-up class like a couple years back, and that was kind of cool to do that, and did a couple open mics. And then I just randomly say dumb stuff on Twitter, and that's how I express myself artistically, but it's not at the level I'd like it to be, because I'd like to be doing more open mics. I think it'd be more fun.
And you interact with airports.
That's true. I do regularly interact with airports, mostly through GIFs. But yeah, that's kind of my limitation. I do wish I did it more. So I'm kind of probably smack in the middle between Patterson and Laura, I would say.
So in light of some of these, you know, very deep thoughts from our listener, I want to thank them for providing this, this kind of foray into getting into this movie. So I guess my question would be is, what are there anything else, things that you want to pull and want to speak about from the movie? I'm curious.
Well, I was as you guys were talking about Patterson, New Jersey, which I've never been to. I was kind of thinking, though, one thing as we've talked about is like the theme of kind of the theme of focusing on the almost lack of major action or activity, as opposed to focusing on that action, which it seems like what most movies do. Like, there's very little conflict in this movie, and I think probably that's the point. Like, that was done on purpose. So maybe, even if that he wanted to not focus on some of the other aspects of Patterson, which are maybe there's more going on, either positive or negative. And he's just saying, well, there's in every place, and it could be this could have taken place almost anywhere, to say that even in, any kind of environment where people live, there's just a lot of stuff happening that most of the time you don't even notice and people don't make movies about, but that those moments and those kind of those experiences are interesting by themselves.
Yeah, I think that that's actually a reasonable point, in that this isn't, we're not talking about a Michael Bay movie. We're talking about a Jim Jarmusch movie.
Yeah.
So it was never going to be, it was going to be everything through his lens. So exactly. In that sense, it was always going to be this very specific journey, very much carved out. I get the impression that it was really inspired a lot. And this could be me taking a complete shot in the dark and completely being wrong, but that those consistent references to William Carlos Williams and his poetry and the sort of the brevity of it. Because what I remember of William Carlos Williams was that, and I could also be getting this wrong, is that he did a lot of his poetry on prescription pads, which is why a lot of it was so short and concise, that he would just get random thoughts, like while he was being a doctor the rest of the time, and just write these short poems on prescription pads. So I think that imbued a lot of sort of the distilled nature that the movie itself is a poem. It's going to get into
you. You're with my buddy.
Yeah. Right? Like, it's totally a poem unto itself. And we're not going to see Patterson as the rest of us have seen it, to the extent that we have, if you haven't been there or not, by reputation or whatever, but we're seeing it through Jarmusch's lens. It's his poem to Patterson. And in that sense, I thought it was enjoyable. I watched it with my wife. She did not like it nearly as much. She just got bored, and I get it, because I think at some point I did write down, it's like slow TV, but as a movie with Adam Driver, which I don't know if I've talked about slow TV on the podcast before. But slow TV is a product of, I think it's Norwegian. These very extended periods of just watching one thing for a very long time. For example, they have 8 hours of a fire kind of like a Yule log, but I think it's National Fireplace Night, and they tell stories. There's one series where it's an entire train ride where they just it's like an 8-hour train ride, and they have a camera just pointing out from the train. And then another one with it's like an 8-hour boat ride, and you just walk for 8 hours straight. You just watch a boat slowly go up the coast. It's kind of amazing. It's available on Pluto TV if you guys are in.
But
I mean, you can get it either as a channel or on
TV,
demand.
It's like, but slow TV. I mean, just from my understanding, because I haven't seen it other than, you know, the loop of Darth Vader burning that I had for earlier this month. Nice. on my TV. But the fact that it's that you're seeing it raw and unedited. It's supposed to be like you're almost like you're experiencing it like for yourself. Is that kind of like the contextual thing behind it, or?
Yeah, well, 100%. Yeah, it's sort of kind of. I think my understanding of the rationale behind slow TV was that it was a way for people to be in front of a TV, kind of be in sitting together in a living room, but being able to experience things together and sort of have that outside simulation of traveling, but at the same time, you know, being able to still have discussions and kind of enjoy things, or even just quietly enjoy it. But yeah, I think that's pretty close to it. I think I end up writing that at some point. It in terms of this being slow TV and very much in the vein of Jim Jarmusch, it was Jim Jarmusch. It a lot of his movies feel like a trip to MoMA. You have a quiet, good time, and you see a lot of random stuff.
Huh. Having never seen any of anything else that he's done other than this, I can see that.
Okay. I think it's I definitely love the movie as a poem kind of thing in a lot of different ways, because if you think about it, those first days that you have him there, things are very much cyclical, almost like your standard your couplet, if you will. You have it isn't necessarily rhyme as was mentioned all the time, but there is kind of a distinct pattern to things, and I think that's interesting. The one time where basically you come out of place here is when things aren't as cyclical. When the bus does break down, and when his friend the bartender basically, has to deal with his own kinds of things, or he's dealing with the what Everett might call star-crossed lovers, at the bar, so to speak. So to me, there is a lot of observation, but I think at the same time, how he sees himself as an observer sometimes, but he's also part of those situations as well. So it's kind of important to be conscious of one's own kind of idea when you're putting yourself in or removing yourself from a piece of art, I guess, in that regard. So
I also thought it was interesting that Adam Driver was also in Marriage Story, which I never actually saw, but for everything I've read about it or seen clips of, it's like the breakdown of his marriage and all like the drama and conflicts as like his marriage falls apart. And this seems like the complete opposite of that type of story.
Yeah, I definitely see. I agree with the listener saying that this is a very comfortable and loving relationship that appears on the screen. I mean, he is 100%. Supportive of her and anything and everything that she does, and she wants nothing than the best for him as well. So I thought that was very beautiful in its own right.
A weird take on that, because I think that analysis is spot on, but as Kate was watching it, she kept wondering if the wife was actually real.
Oh, interesting.
Like, because it kind of felt like there were definitely times where she felt a little ethereal, like her.
Yeah.
A little too out there. Like, honestly, it felt a little annoying. She was annoying at times to me.
Right.
And then I think she was waiting for this twist where she's like, she's not actually real. I mean, that's not a Jarmusch thing at all. And from my understanding of his work. So I think it was going to play out that way, but it would have been interesting to me. I mean, maybe she isn't real.
Think they show that, at least they, not on screen, they don't show her interacting with any other characters.
Yeah. True. That's true.
Other than the dog, who kills it the entire time.
Dog. Yeah, yeah. Marvin was my dog until that one point in the movie. Then he was no longer my dog. But no, but yeah, but I think, you know, contextually speaking, you know, this is, I think, like Naya was saying, a Jarmusch, you know, special, if you will. And it's not Michael Bay. It's not David Mamet. It's not a witty dialogue from Aaron Sorkin. You know, it's a style all to its own.
And it's definitely a different type of movie slash show that we've seen on the podcast so far, or that we've talked about on the podcast so far. So
yeah, I think this is definitely a lot. I mean, not that all of the series we talked about aren't, you know, thought provoking, so to speak. I think this is definitely a little bit more. It inspires more creativity and philosophy in nature, so to speak. It's, you know, I mean, to quote, you know, a certain other filmmaker, it's like poetry, it rhymes. That's George Lucas, for those who don't know that.
Fair enough.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, Patterson is no Outer Banks, but, you know, it's still pretty good.
Yeah. I mean,
it was slow, like a New Jersey transit bus is slow.
Yeah, I totally agree with that statement.
But I honestly like the sweeping visual approach to it. And it reminded me how much I kind of like and fetishize, probably, I would say fetishize. I enjoy it. Just the visual appeal of mild urban decay.
Right.
Which I think is the case in Patterson, at least last time I was there. Like just those random buildings. I mean, kind of random factories being abandoned and stuff like that. Like, I like that, you know, it is fetishization of decay, but I do enjoy it. So that was kind of cool to watch.
But the way I see it is that, you know, Patterson in both the character name and Patterson as the city, you know, within the spoiler alert for, you know, the last part of the movie, basically, you think about this is that sometimes an empty page presents the most possibilities. And the same can be said as Patterson of the character in, you know, renewing his approach and his, you know, his expression of his poetry again, even after having lost his, you know, his foundation, his previous foundation. And Patterson, even though it's kind of, you know, had its heyday from the days of Costello, from Evan Costello, I did not know Fetty Wap was from Patterson, but, you know, they had their own, you know, a bunch of people that were all, you know, part of their heyday, like, you know, we'd mentioned previously. But I think that, you know, but again, if there is an empty factory, if there is an empty point, you know, it is possible for. And, you know, not just individuals or actual human beings, but entities, if you will, that are comprised of, you know, other living beings or other living and non-living things. It's not impossible for them to find new possibilities. And I think there are a lot of places out there that have definitely seen a tremendous amount of urban renewal. So, I mean, so I try to, you know, take a little bit of optimism, I guess, from everything.
Fair enough. I did have a note about the city of Patterson paying Jim Jarmusch to do this as a way to promote Patterson.
That is entirely hilarious.
Wait, did that actually happen?
No, it's just a thing I made up. Also, like, that amazing end credit scene that only shows up if you watch the movie from the very start to the very end without pausing, that I definitely didn't make up to mess with people. that also exists. I do think it's funny because I think, the pitcher did mention a cameo. But he didn't mention who he was talking about in the cameo, but I think I know who he's talking about.
I know who he's talking about.
Scott, who do you think he was talking about in terms of the cameo?
Well, like a cameo from a well-known person in the movie?
Yeah, yeah. What's your guess?
I don't know.
Dan, you want to say it at the same time?
Oh, sure.
1, 2, 3. Method Man?
Method Man.
Yeah. Just hanging out in a laundromat, just wrapping in a laundromat.
So the answer is, where the F you at, Patterson?
To Cal.
Exactly. Yeah,
that was pretty good. That was very random.
Yeah, but it was great that, you know, you got to see him kind of in his own creative element of sorts. You know, sometimes, you know, you need to spin up or spin down. Your lyrical bars when you're out there, be at the laundromat, pun intended, or not.
It's true. Oh, Scott, Method Man is a member of the Wu-Tang Clan. He's also been an actor. He's gotten a decent acting career going. He was in a David Simon's The Deuce, and he's been in plenty of other stuff too. Kind of randomly, he's actually really branched out quite a bit as an actor. But definitely got to start as a member of the Wu-Tang Clan.
Cool. I also like the brief role from Chidi from The Good Place.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It took me a hot second. I'm like, huh? That guy looks familiar. But yeah, I thought the cast was really, really neat. I recognize the bartender from I couldn't put my finger on where I'd see. I feel like I've seen it in a couple different things, but the one that was like sticking in my mind, it turns out he played a professor / doctor in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. actually. So that's why I was like, I know I've seen him in something more recently than some of these other stuff I've seen him in. And I'm like, that was it. So it's very funny how, you know, your past memories of different performances kind of intersect with each other. So
I was actually looking at Method Man's IMDb. Scott, he was Cheese in The Wire. Does that help?
It's been a while since I've seen The Wire, but okay.
But still, outside of that, no idea who Method Man is.
I've heard of him, and I've heard of Wu-Tang Clan, so there you go.
There you go.
But Nine, you were talking about the urban decay aspect of it, but I thought that bridge and the waterfall looked pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's one place in Patterson. It's
Yeah, that's...
There's a lot more in Patterson than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the place, like I said, as part of the tourism money that allegedly went into the film. You know, no, again, it's every city has, you know, its up points, its down points. This is a place that I guess, you know, was meant to be kind of very zen like in some ways, where, you know, people, you know, but we're poets of like mind now, as we now know, go to kind of think about things or observe things or, you know, get reconnected with themselves, if you will.
Yeah. But while it may not be an accurate representation of what Patterson is to most folks, I like that this Patterson exists, and it's kind of inspiration for maybe Patterson to be more like that going in the future. And I think even though it clearly is focused on Patterson, the person, Patterson, the city, is definitely a character in this as well. So it's cool to see this version of Patterson as someone who's spent time in Patterson and not wanted to be there at the time. Ultimately, it was cool to see this movie be a better version, the kind of Patterson that I'd want to be in.
Yeah. No. And I think the cupcakes did look good, and I kind of want a cupcake right now.
Oh, that's fair.
But
and I realized
what about the secret pie though? How did everyone feel about the secret pie?
I didn't mind it. I would have eaten that. I was down for that pie.
I mean, Brussels sprouts and cheddar. I mean, sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, I mean, no bacon, but I'll live. I'm good with Brussels sprouts and cheddar.
Was it like just add some eggs and you got a quiche?
Facts.
True.
Yeah, I mean, it was really shocking because like it took me a second to realize, you know, it, you know, when I realized he did not have a cell phone, and yet we were like kind of in amidst all this technology, you know, especially, right. you know, it was very interesting to see like, oh, because there's only like, I think one of the person that I know that does not have a cell phone, like, you know, so it's very interesting to see contextually how those people do things. But again, we all lived and did things before cell phones. So it's like, I want, if it is a prescription pad, you know, a la William Carlos Williams, you know, or if it is, you know, a notebook, you have ways of to do things both creatively and functionally. But I mean, in this day and age, it definitely would, especially when your car phone or your bus phone rather dies, it would be very, very helpful to have one, I think. Yeah.
Oh, 100%.
I would love to think that maybe not immediately after this, the con of this movie, but maybe in 3 to 6 months, he would have an ancient flip phone that he would only turn on when he was on a route and only would use in emergencies.
A Motorola StarTech.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I imagine him to kind of. He's like the Gibbs of to NCIS as he would be to the bus driving crew for New Jersey Transit in Patterson.
Sorry, I'm only familiar with NCIS New Orleans. so this is all lost on me.
But I do love one other quote that was said towards the movie as well. Is I definitely feel this a lot. A poetry in translation is like shower in a raincoat. And if you've ever read poetry or listened to poetry from another language, I think there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, for me, most of the poetry that I've been exposed to obviously has been in Spanish, specifically Neruda. If you read Neruda in the actual his actual language in Spanish, basically it's a totally different way of immersing yourself than if you were reading his translation. Not that translations aren't bad, it's just that I think that there's a lot more. You're hearing things more kind of like as they were meant to be heard, if you will. So I do understand that quote a lot.
Yeah, no, that was a really good point. Actually, I enjoyed that scene. That was really cool.
Yeah, that's probably one of my favorite scenes in the movie. There's a couple of other ones that were also really, really awesome as well.
Agreed.
Yeah, but all in all, yeah, I think I really, really enjoyed it. I think other than coffee and cigarettes, I might have to go back now and watch more of Jarmusch's stuff right now for sure, because I'm kind of curious to see where he's coming from these other perspectives.
His more recent stuff has been kind of maybe moving away from that a little bit, the earlier stuff. But
I've seen Mystery Train, for example, so I definitely would want to come go back to that. It sounds like
totally worth it. It's a fun, quirky run. But his newer stuff, like Only Lovers Left Alive and The Dead Don't Die. Actually, I think Adam Driver is in The Dead Don't Die. He's been taking some interesting kind of genre-specific approaches. Like The Dead Don't Die is a zombie movie with Adam Driver and Bill Murray. So that, like, he's definitely been branching out a bit. But I think this falls more into classic Jim Jarmusch as opposed to the later stuff that's getting a little bit more mainstream, as mainstream as it can get.
Right. So, but would you say that collectively people might be asking Adam Driver to, clothesline me with those tremendous tree trunks of arms?
Yes. Cool. Cool.
Yes. Just a little spread of John Oliver for you.
Thank you. So, listeners, I guess that's what we thought.
All right, I'm back again to do another pitch here. I'm going back to sci-fi roots, surprise, surprise, and we're going to be talking about The Expanse TV series. This is based on a series of novels by James S.A. Corey, and it was developed by Mark Fergus and Hawk Ospie, and is available on Amazon Prime for your viewing pleasure. So I'm going to start off by saying, science fiction is a very broad genre, and there's so many kind of sub-genres within it, because you've got fantasy and you've got a lot of other kinds of sub you're more kind of even niche kind of sections here. But there's one section of it that I would call a little bit, that is probably more what I call hard science fiction. And what I mean by that is that there's a lot of fantasy level stuff where you think about the galaxy far, far away. You think about to boldly go or play or no one has gone before. And a lot of these deal with technology that is well beyond any kind of real means or is basically physically impossible by the known laws of physics, if you will. And contains minerals or elements that don't exist in the whole nine yards. And so I think that what I like about hard science fiction is that it takes where we currently are at and it kind of gently pushes us into the future, but kind of keeps things remotely realistic so that it's a little bit easier to understand to agree, but it also makes things a little more believable. So I call hard science fiction kind of another subgenre within science fiction. So anything that's based on some of the more traditional writers, in some ways might be construed as coming from that. But I think that so this is a hard science fiction show, but it does deal with the unknown as well, because space is always an unknown when you talk about things in that context. So it has received a lot of critical acclaim, across the board here. It's got it received a Hugo Award and I think a couple other awards as well. It's currently airing its sixth and final season because the novels have also concluded as well right now. I actually been playing catch up with another nerd related group via Discord by watching this. And so that's kind of why it's fresh in my mind. I really wanted to kind of, you know, get on and talk about it, because I definitely feel very passionate about a number of different aspects of the series. So, you know, I have not read the source material yet. I fully intend to go back and read them probably at the conclusion of the series, just because I kind of want to see, you know, where the TV series has departed from the books. Again, a lot of people have done the same thing with your Lord of the Rings, etc. So it's very kind of a cool thing to do when you have the time and ability to do so. So hopefully I will have the former in the future. So a little bit about the series itself. So the Expanse, you know, obviously, like I said, it takes place a little bit further in the future. At this point in time, humans have kind of spread further past Earth and past Mars and a little further than that. And so there's kind of three, you know, major, I guess, political entities that exist right now. So you have Earth, which is obviously the home planet. You have Mars, and you have what they call the Belt. So the Belts are the people, it's anything beyond Mars, towards Jupiter, and even Saturn and beyond or whatnot. So there's kind of three different sections, if you will. And what's interesting about the Expanse is that it kind of follows a bunch of players that are all, you know, experiencing something within this vast realm that humanity now encompasses. And what I really loved about the series is that it is very character driven, but it also does a lot of great work with kind of understanding motivations, you know, desires, and also complex relationships that exist in the cosmos here. So, the protagonists, basically, you see in the first couple of episodes are member of the UN Security Council, and you see a police detective that is located on a space station named Ceres. And then you also have a mining ship's officer, basically, and his crew that occur there. So what happens is that a series of events in this first episode kind of cascade into what expands into a solar system level conflict eventually. So, and it's very interesting how unstable nature between the entities of Earth, Mars, and the Belt kind of play into the larger kind of realm of things. And like I said, it does eventually branch out a little bit. It is a solar system-wide thing, but it does kind of go a little bit more into the beyond as you delve deeper and deeper and deeper into the series.
So to just to briefly interject, when I heard the title The Expanse, my first thought was that it sounds like a documentary series about a zoning board committee, series of zoning board committee movies, trying to evaluate what to do with a vacant lot. And everything you've described so far makes it sound like I'm not too far off, and it's just a bigger vacant lot than I thought.
HOA, et cetera, you're going to have, you know, political entities that exist in that context. You're going to have people that are the kind of people you might see in that. I can't remember which insurance commercial it was, basically, who literally came over and chopped down the neighbor's mailbox because it was 3 inches beyond code for the HOA. So you have people like that who are, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, sticklers. And then you have people basically who are kind of like, well, you know, it'd be nice to turn into a community garden or a park. And you have people that are saying, well, you know, we should turn into a parking lot or a utility closet of sorts. Again, you have, again, depending upon what their agenda is, you know, they're going to have a different way to go about that. So you take the microcosm that is that association, you were to scale it up to a solar system size level, there could be a lot of similarities for sure.
So it is about zoning.
It's partially about zoning, but it's also about self-determination. It's also about, the limits of what's moral or ethical on both a scientific perspective, on an exploratory perspective, and also how mankind's, it was, I can't call it a diaspora, but mankind's exploration and expansion beyond Earth has created situational issues in these complex relationships that exist throughout the solar system for mankind.
Man, if they grant no less than 3 easements and a pertinent, I'm in. Like, I'm here for the easements, you guys.
Yeah,
this sounds great.
Well, I went more into a lot more kind of the brainy aspects of this, but visually, the show is actually really, really pretty incredible as well. You know, I really definitely, you know, enjoy the visuals a lot, and they do a lot of really great work, both in, you know, interior and exteriors with the ship using CG, and also showing things on Earth and elsewhere. Again, they really are kind of really trying to basically think about, okay, based on our current rate of development and our current, you know, structures as it deals with, they say, the UN, for example, and, you know, how could we develop in the future once, you know, let's say, you know, Blue Origin aside, you know, how are we going to kind of look in, say, X hundreds of years, you know, when we are kind of fully kind of attempting to kind of take our first real steps out into the greater cosmos.
Sounds like also, though, there's some political intrigue.
Yes.
Right, yeah, the zoning board.
Exactly.
I know. Yeah, very intriguing. Yeah,
so, obviously, if you think about, like, you know, how it relates historically to the expansion, say, to the New World as we might know it. You know, when these people that affectionately call themselves colonists, who some may see as imperialists, obviously, you're already creating a certain dynamic amongst the aboriginal population versus the incoming population that is seeking to spread out or perhaps maybe get some resources or some of the cases. And because, you know, harvesting resources as opposed to just extorting or you're emptying out the proverbial coffers that is the environment or the area that you're going into, you know, if you don't contextually have a base or moral or ethical understanding of how that goes by, you know, there you create a situation where you have haves and you have have-nots. And, you know, and it creates structures of multiple classes of citizenry, either by design or by how it works out. And, you know, and just per, you know, Scott's point, or and also per the, again, just with the zoning board, you have people that are actually have officer level positions that actually have theoretical power as the charter or constitution might dictate there, but it the same may exist in the context of a larger political entities as it relates to the solar system. So,
and you said there are 6 seasons.
Yeah, there's 6 seasons, a total of 59 episodes, I believe, right now. But again, the runtime for these is, you know, in that kind of 45-minute window around there. So the idea would be to watch the first 2. This is definitely more of, like I said, it's a hard science fiction long burn series. So again, I think that you know, I think that because the character drive and everything and the visuals and everything comes together in such a way where I think it really is it hooked me in immediately. I watched again. I was thinking, oh, you know, I'll watch an episode, see how I feel, and I got hooked pretty well. So, you know, when we started catching up, it was a rewatch for some people out there, but for me it was a first time watch, and we were watching some of these sometimes, you know, 3 to 4 at a clip. And sometimes I'd be like, oh man, I wish I could watch the next one right now. But it's like, I had to wait, you know, a couple days before we did the next round of watching. But, you know, and again, you know, I think that I want, you know, and if you watch it contextually in the realm of, you know, your association, that's awesome. I think you might get a little bit of insight there. But I think also if you watch it strictly from a character driven story perspective, I think there's a lot you can take from it for sure. And the longer you stick with it, I think there's definitely more and more and more of a reward, and there's a ton of, you know, interesting you know, characters that kind of, you know, kind of come through as the series goes on for sure.
Are there any actors we may recognize
So the person who plays the UN Security Council representative is the character's name is Christian Avasarala, and she is played by Shore Agdashalu. I'm probably butchering her name, so I apologize. But I guarantee you've seen her in other things. There's some of the other main characters are played by Thomas Jane, Stephen Strait, Kassan Var, Dominic Tipper. So none of these people are really, I would call, A-list level celebrities in that regard. But I think that they have been in a bunch of other kinds of longer series. In some cases, they've been in science fiction, and they do have a bunch of guest stars. I think there will over time you might recognize some people over time and whatnot. A couple people that looked familiar to me. Cass Anvar, for example, was one that definitely looks familiar to me because I think I've seen him in other science fiction, kinds of shows. And I think I've seen because I've seen him in where I've seen him in. He's been in a bunch of other smaller shows, but I can't remember where I've seen him before. But maybe he just has a familiar face too as well. But there's a lot of people. I think that I think the people they got were very well casted for the characters. Down the line, I mean, there's one of my favorite characters doesn't come unfortunately until season three, but David Strathairn plays and he's tremendous. I thought in the way he did his role. But again, you might see someone you might recognize. Again, you definitely need to have your IMDb trigger finger ready to kind of see if you recognize anybody for sure. So,
fair enough. Not a requirement certainly to be a good show. I just was kind of curious because I've heard about it randomly, but it never pulled me in because I'm just not as much of a sci-fi person. Probably because I didn't know as folks that were associated with, but hey, let's give it a shot.
Hey, David Strathairn and zoning boards sounds good to me.
Yeah, it's David Strathairn. If you can make it to season three, that is. So you have to be able to,
okay.
Yeah, you got to make it to season three to get him. So I think that the more you get sucked into. At first, there's a lot of it starts off like a lot of series out there that can have this long burn. It's like you've got these different circles that eventually kind of they eventually start overlapping with each other, and that's when the mystery kind of really starts to unfold even further. And then within the mystery, there's other mysteries and conundrums, etc. So that's what, again, really in my mind sucked a lot of people into the series.
Mm. So. Yeah, I'm intrigued for sure. This is I am a sci-fi fan, but and I've heard about this from time to time, but kind of like what Nyan was saying, I just never gave it a go so far.
I think that there is less of a, I think definitely there's like less of a, what I would call a commercial or marketing level draw to this. I mean, we mentioned before, Michael Bay, when he gets involved with something, there's gonna be lots of explosions, lots of this. And so there's a lot of, contextually, people draw to that, or if it's another kind of intellectual property that people know about, they know about Star Wars, know about Star Trek, they know about, now there's another Babylon 5 project coming down the line even. So it's like, yeah, so there's all these different, more, I'd say, well-established continuums that exist. Whereas this, like I said, it came out of novels like a lot of the sci-fi does, but I think the interpretation of this, I think, on a TV perspective, because I don't have the novel context yet, but I think that what we presented on a television perspective has been tremendously entertaining. So,
If you're not a sci-fi person, what's going to pull you into this?
Characters are really, I feel like they're very I think they're believable contextually speaking. There are some scenes, honestly, where you might contextually forget that it's taking place in space because again, there's so much. There's drama. There is obviously some humor interspersed within it, obviously, but there's a lot of, very, again, one of your main characters is a police detective on a space station. So there's also that kind of aspect of things. You see like someone who's involved in politics, someone who's involved in policing, you see someone who is kind of more of your every man, or he alleges to be an every man, seeing his life, working as a kind of, he's, instantly, you learn in the first episode, but he's third in command in the vessel that he's on. So he's a kind of a lower level. He's not a senior officer, but he's a higher level officer than your grunts on the ship. But you know, you kind of see him and how he relates to the rest of the crew and how things, you know, move over time. But there is action. There is a mixture of a lot of different things as it comes down to it. I think that, you know, you could watch this series as a sci-fi nut, but you could also watch a series purely just as a character driven slow burn suspense / drama.
As someone who still has access to the USA Network, characters are welcome. So
does that include a Mitzi Kaptur from Silk Stockings?
It always includes Mitzi Kaptur from Silk Stockings.
glad we got that out there.
Was it Rob Estes? Was that the other guy?
Yes, that is correct.
Oh my god, yeah.
And I feel like was Rob Estes also in the Tech War movies? Was that him?
Maybe, but was that Greg Evigan?
Oh, that was Greg Evigan. You're right. I'm sorry.
One of my two dads.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we will give it a try, Dan, and I'll let you know what we think.
Well, we tried. That brings us to the end of another episode of the Watch OK Please podcast. Please join us next week for another exercise in futility. In the meantime, please rate and review us on iTunes. Or if you didn't listen to this on iTunes, please complain about us on your social media platform of choice. Good night, everybody.